Hello and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. This is our news episode. We'll be discussing the latest news from February and early March. So we'll discuss the latest price action, the latest news. And joining me is Alex. How are you, Alex?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Dan. Hi, everyone.
Alex, do you have any news items?
Yeah, I got some news items to start us off, for sure. I think one that's interesting and which we've had like a, I guess, I don't know if we'd call it a resolution or maybe just a brief intermission at the moment, is the US government through the Department of Energy. They are trying to collect information on Bitcoin mining operations in the US. And if you know anything about it already, this has been going on for, roughly about a month ago, they issued an emergency request for information. I'm not sure on the actual designation or categorization, but basically telling all Bitcoin miners in the US that they had to provide a whole host of information about their operations, how much energy they're using, what rate they're paying for energy, what type of miners they have, a whole bunch of information that's well beyond what is probably, well, I would just say there's no reasonable amount of information for them to ask for, but yeah, even just the average person would probably understand that this is well beyond what is reasonable to ask for, and it goes into the sensitive level of information that's where the Bitcoin miners have their edge against each other. So competing Bitcoin miners, you know, about how they do recycling and replacement of ASICs, that kind of thing.
Is there any speculation where you about?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of speculation about the intent, and that's basically an attempt to KYC miners, find out about what they're doing, and then basically just seeking as much information as possible so that you can cherry pick that data set and form a narrative against Bitcoin mining. So we know it's not an overall threat to Bitcoin because Bitcoin miners are portable, they can move anywhere in the world, but is a threat to Bitcoin mining in the US, which currently hosts a huge percentage of the hash rate, because it's got very favorable conditions so far. So maybe that will change. The reason I say there's been a bit of an intermission, though, is because the Texas Blockchain Council has been pushing back pretty heavily against this, and it seems like the miners in the US have been relatively organized, and they've managed to get an injunction or some kind of court settlement, which has meant that this has been halted for now. So it's quite a good sign, but we'll see where it goes going forwards.
That's interesting. I just saw, like, there was a video recently of a Bitcoin mine in Texas. It was supposed to be the biggest Bitcoin mining site in Texas. Did you see that on Twitter?
No, I didn't.
Okay, it's like a huge facility. It made me think like how far Bitcoin came. It was huge. It looked like kilometers wide. It looked like a proper mine site. It made me think that, like, you know, 12 years ago, Satoshi was just mining on his home computer. Now there's this like huge industrial size mine site being built.
The first Bitcoin ASIC was 2012 or 2013, something like that. So that's just over 10 years. And we have this, yeah, it's expanded worldwide into this massive industrial level operation. Pretty impressive.
I'll go back to a little bit of the ETFs. So I found a tweet that was pretty interesting by somebody called Eric Baukunas. He's a senior ETF analyst for Bloomberg. And he tweeted this 27th of February, so about 8 days ago. He said that the BlackRock ETF, IBIT, has traded 1 billion worth of shares today so far, which ranks it 11th among all ETFs and top 25 among stocks. In sign a number for a newbie ETF, especially one with competitors. So, and that's just one ETF, and there's obviously other Bitcoin ETFs. And so it's already like one of the top ETFs.
Most successful ETF launch ever.
That's right. And you mentioned about the exchanges, but they haven't had that much traffic. But apparently I read that Coinbase just recently crashed. And when Coinbase crashes because, you know, of high traffic, so probably like it's not quite as much. Like I think there'll be more increase in retail, but it clearly there is some because Coinbase crashed already. And that's also another sign that we're in a bull market, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because Coinbase does the custody for a lot of the ETFs in the background. So I'm not sure if the crash is specifically related to just their custody or whether it's their exchange website. One thing I did read about that, though, is that they had a very low estimate for the amount of traffic that they had prepared for. It was like something like they had only prepared and tested up to 10 times their normal traffic flows. which is ridiculous because they regularly exceed that during bull runs. So they knew this was coming, or is still yet to come, and it sounds like they haven't really prepared for it, not adequately anyway. So yeah, it's kind of funny. I've got another one. This was actually a rare win in the courts. We had another rare win recently with the Texas Blockchain Council pushing back on the harvesting of information, but this is another one from Europe. So European Court of Human Rights has ruled that laws requiring crippled encryption and extensive data retention violate the European Convention on Human Rights. So basically, governments trying to pass laws to break end-to-end encryption or force services to backdoor encryption, it's been ruled a violation of human rights. And this is, yeah, a definite rare win, because if we look back, you know, the last several decades, it seems like it's an inevitable grind of erosion of these kinds of rights or protections. A little bit more information. So the legislation, it's come off the back of a legal challenge from all the way back in 2017, when Russia requested information from Telegram to help decrypt users' communication. And then that was initially challenged but dismissed. And then it's just continued on to the point where it's reached the European Court of Human Rights.
Okay. So a good win. So next item, I've got, there's the court case between Craig Wright, where the person who's pretending to be Satoshi Nakamoto, the inventor of Bitcoin, and he's suing some developers trying to get access to some funds. But anyway, as part of that court case, one of the earliest Bitcoin collaborators, Martti Sirius Maumi from Finland, released his entire email history with Satoshi Nakamoto. So there was some, I read them. It was interesting to read them. There was nothing like super like big there. It was still interesting to know some kind of insights and some of the discussions from those very, very early days that Satoshi Nakamoto had. And he just made some predictions about the network. And one of the predictions he made was that he envisioned that at its max, Bitcoin would have around 100,000 Bitcoin nodes, where right now it actually has 50,000. It was just, did you see those emails?
Yeah, I did. I actually read through them quite a lot of them. Yeah, it's really interesting, I thought. I agree, there's no major like revelations, like it hasn't uncovered who Satoshi is or something like that. Not that we really want to know that. I think the real interesting thing about these emails in particular, though, is that Sirius is sort of the first person to work with Satoshi for like an extended period of time. Like you could kind of consider him the first, like, I guess, developer on the project. He wrote a lot of the initial like FAQ, like the frequently asked questions for the website, and helped Satoshi with a lot of, I guess, setting up the initial areas around the Bitcoin, sort of like the wider thing, as well as did some code as well, I believe.
If somebody's interested, they can go look up and read through the emails and have that. It's kind of very like, interesting bit of history about Bitcoin, and they can research it.
Another bit of Bitcoin news or Bitcoin adjacent news. So we had Nayib Bukele, the president of El Salvador, which is, you know, Bitcoin's capital, I guess, at the moment. So he was reelected in a huge, huge win at the start of the month. I don't know if it speaks exactly to the Bitcoin strategy. I think that maybe still has a ways to play off, but the wider approach to governing that's in line with Bitcoin ethos is obviously proving to be extremely popular, at least in El Salvador.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and good on him. And he's, you know, because obviously El Salvador bought Bitcoin. It holds Bitcoin on its balance sheet, the country of El Salvador, as its kind of national fund. So that's going to be good for him also and went up. And actually, I've got a kind of a related news story. I read this on Bitcoin.com. And I'll read the title. El Salvador stands firm on Bitcoin, defying IMF's renewed call to drop Bitcoin as a legal tender. I'll read the first paragraph. El Salvador has reaffirmed its commitment to embracing Bitcoin despite the International Monetary Fund's repeated calls for the country to drop the currency as a legal tender. The Salvadoran vice president emphasized that not only will El Salvador Bitcoin lobby maintained, but at the moment the cryptocurrency also enjoys the greatest credibility in the world. It's interesting because a lot of these kind of old style kind of organizations, economists, and kind of like mocked, and news organizations also, they mocked El Salvador and Bukele
it's going to be great when we see them in the next few months when they all come out and they're going to apologize, of course, and retract their previous articles, aren't they? They're definitely going to be intellectually honest about it.
Yeah. I wonder if part of it is also International Monetary Fund. This kind of organization, when we were set up, we were very intertwined with very kind of, I guess, the kind of US Atlantic system, but all these organizations like NATO, the IMF, they're all kind of created really to kind of, well, part of this kind of system, right? I guess, or you could say, this kind of dominance and US dollar dominance. And probably a big part of it is they don't want other countries copying what El Salvador's doing, right? Like El Salvador's having success, it bought Bitcoins, having success. And I wonder if, you know, if they don't like, they don't want this to be a precedent set for other countries to follow.
Yeah, they're going to resist it at every stage. They're going to put up as much fight as they can whilst retaining as much credibility as they can. So it's a delicate balance because the more they screech about El Salvador, the more they get proved wrong. So they will be trying to balance that and they'll be trying to minimize how absurd their takes are. But yeah, it's a one-way street, as we know.
Yeah, but yeah, I wonder if there'll be more countries copying El Salvador's lead. And that's actually what Edward Snowden made a tweet recently where he actually predicted just that. He said he predicted that in like this year, in 2024, there will be more countries adopting Bitcoin on their balance sheet.
Are you going to make a prediction? Which country do you think?
I don't know. Edward Snowden made that prediction. I think it's going to be another small country. I think if the next country to hold Bitcoin its balance sheet, I think it's going to be probably maybe South American country also, because, you know, close to El Salvador, so they probably have that kind of connection and they probably would be looking what they're doing. So I'm guessing like another smaller country.
Yeah, I think it needs to be a small country because the smaller the country, like the more flexible and agile the governance structure is, whatever it is. A little bit of hopium maybe, or a little bit of speculation. I think I've seen a bit of talk around the idea of it being Qatar. So maybe not South America, but I mean, Qatar, all these Arab countries have, you know, fairly centralized control. It means they can move quickly, make big decisions at a high level relatively quickly. I know that Qatar sent a delegation to El Salvador around September last year. And then there was a Qatari private jet was spotted at Madeira at Bitcoin Atlantis, which is one of the major Bitcoin conferences, which is happening right now. So there's definitely some big interest out of Qatar.
Yeah, that's actually a good prediction also. I can see that happening. Those countries are small and they could kind of do something like that. And they're trying to attract innovation and technology. I think part of the reason is a lot of these places like Europe and America especially, they're very kind of burdened by this kind of legacy dollar system. They're kind of the ones who created but in control of that, so they would be more reluctant to let that go. But some place like Qatar doesn't have much to lose, and they're pretty open to that kind of innovation. And there's already in Dubai, at least, a lot of Bitcoin and crypto people live there. A lot of the businesses actually rebased their headquarters to Dubai.
Well, in terms of the way that countries might get into it, I listened to a recent interview with Samson Mao, who's, if you haven't heard of Samson, Samson's very involved in trying to orange pill nations and governments, involved with the El Salvador rollout. And then, yeah, he's been talking to a whole bunch of players. But he sort of indicates that most of the discussions he has is not about countries buying Bitcoin necessarily. It's more about how that they can use Bitcoin mining to monetize energy assets. And so he says that's really the avenue of entry for the major country or large players in countries. And with that in mind, there was some news last week. So the Ethiopian Sovereign Wealth Fund is planning to start mining Bitcoin and settled a $250 million preliminary agreement. So they'll be partnering with an undisclosed international company. And the final deal hasn't fully been settled yet, but they've got a preliminary agreement signed for infrastructure, for data mining, artificial intelligence, and then Bitcoin mining as well. And that's $250 million.
Yeah, but that makes sense for countries mining centers and start getting Bitcoin. And yeah, that could be an entry point for them to actually start holding that Bitcoin also.
I've got one more, which is kind of interesting as well. Nigerian authorities have blamed Binance for their 70% Naira, which is the Nigerian currency devaluation, and they've issued an arrest warrant for the CEO of Binance. Essentially, Nigerian Naira is a shitcoin, like all countries' currencies, but this is a particularly bad shitcoin. And as a result, the people of Nigeria have been switching to Bitcoin and probably even to a larger extent to stablecoins like Tether on Tron, those kinds of things. And Binance has obviously been integral in sort of providing a lot of the infrastructure that helps to run, especially those sort of stablecoin shitcoins. Like they've got their own Binance chain and things like that. And so Nigeria is clamping down, and they've arrested, I believe, two sort of senior representatives from Binance who were in the country at the time. And yeah, they're trying to make a move on CZ.
So speaking of stablecoins, I've got an item related to them. Tether's audit report reveals it has 2.8 billion in Bitcoin holdings. Because some people question whether like Tether holds the assets, but so there was an audit and they found that they do hold 2.8 billion, probably more now because that was like 2 weeks ago. And holds 5 billion reserves excess. And so for this news, it's made more profit than Goldman Sachs last quarter. So, like, you know, I mean, yeah, it's like a new financial future, you know, like Goldman Sachs is old legacy system. Tether is a new start, new kind of financial institutions.
And by comparison to Goldman Sachs, just a tiny team, right? Tether is tiny in terms of just manpower and like the number of people working on Tether.
Compared to Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah.
So another kind of news, a mining company called Marathon Mining or something similar to that, they launched a product, Slipstream, which basically allows people to directly submit any kind of non-standard Bitcoin transaction to the blockchain. So normally most miners don't allow that, but most of these non-standard transactions are usually blocked, but this is a miner who directly mines Bitcoin, and you can, I'm guessing, creating a service like a website, and you can probably paste that data for that non-standard transaction, and they'll, you pay for that and out of band, and that gets added to the blockchain. I think this is probably aimed at ordinals people, because previously to do the ordinals, you had to kind of run a node and actually do it yourself. But here, this time you can just pay and add an ordinal using this service. What do you think of this, Alex?
Yeah, well, I think Mara is a bad actor. So if you've got mining hash rate, you should be moving it away from Marathon. So Mara is their stock ticker. From my point of view, this is just a straight up attack on Bitcoin. I think they own all their infrastructure. If you invest in mining,
this is not financial advice,
then you should, in my opinion, you should be selling Mara and buying another mining operator that supports your goals for the network. If you think that Bitcoin is sound money and, you know, you want Bitcoin to fix this, then Mara is objectively working against those goals. So, yeah, I think it's very clear. I do acknowledge that it's not clear for everyone, and I'm hoping to talk at Bush Bash if I can get myself organized like specifically on this, because I've got strong opinions on this. Yeah. If I was to summarize the way it works, we have consensus rules in Bitcoin, right? So consensus rules basically decide what goes in and what doesn't go into a block. You know, things like, does the transaction comply with the 21 million limit? Is it trying to double spend? There's like basic things, basic rules we have that determine whether something is valid and is part of Bitcoin or not. However, the way that we route transactions to miners in the Bitcoin network relies on the mempool. So every node connects to a whole bunch of other nodes. And the way that miners receive transactions is that you send your transaction from your node, it gets routed and propagated through the network, and then the miners receive it. And to minimize attacks on the Bitcoin peer-to-peer network, it's necessary to have additional rules above and beyond that of consensus to prevent denial of service. And so what this sets up is it's a dynamic where there are transactions that can be put into a Bitcoin block which are valid under consensus rules, but which most nodes will choose not to relay on the Bitcoin peer-to-peer network because it opens up an attack vector on that specific node. So an example of this might be like something like if you had a transaction and you relay it on the peer-to-peer network, and then you immediately replace by fee, like upgrade the fee rate on that by a tiny amount, then yes, it's now in the miner's interest to mine that into a new block. However, if you could just up the fee by, you know, 0.1 of a Satoshi each time, then you could spam the peer-to-peer network and use up all the bandwidth for a fraction of to relay this transaction. So it could be, without having additional policy rules around what gets relayed, it becomes very cheap to spam the peer-to-peer network. The reason that they are able to do this is because there's a difference between the consensus rules and then the what's called standardness on the peer-to-peer network. And so it sets up this dynamic where there's a wider range of things that will be accepted into a block than will get relayed by the peer-to-peer network.
Yeah, I understand. Because normally nodes wouldn't propagate that data. So normally it wouldn't be propagated on the network. So normally it wouldn't go in. But a miner can directly put it in. If like basically you're contacting the miner directly and they'll put that on the blockchain network. Because I think some people might be confused. The controversy about this, because it probably already knows, which are kind of like JPEGs on the blockchain. And a lot of people don't think we should be putting JPEGs on the blockchain because they think it's a waste of blockchain space. Normally, a lot of these kind of transactions won't be relayed, but this makes it easier for people to put those kind of JPEGs and this kind of data on the blockchain directly, which some people think is spamming and waste of blockchain space. I would say it's spammy, but it's not completely spam.
I look forward to educating you.
I'm not taking sides in this debate. I'm just trying to educate people. There is actually a limit. Like I'm just trying to understand, but they still have to pay. So they can't kind of completely spam it.
Yeah, and the block size limit still applies. That's also true.
I'm not trying to take a position on this, but I'm just trying to so people understand.
Well, if I was to summarize the problems are that non-monetary activity on the Bitcoin blockchain degrades the monetary properties of Bitcoin. So if you have a whole bunch of arbitrary data going onto the Bitcoin blockchain, then that increases the cost to run a node, even if the degree to which that is the case is important to factor in. But objectively, it does increase the cost, like it's an additional burden on node operators. And it also increases the fees that would otherwise be paid. So those are the two sort of key things that arbitrary data on the blockchain affects. The reason that we need to push back very heavily against out-of-band operators like Mara is that it leads towards mining centralization. And that's because if you are receiving out-of-band transactions as a mining pool or a miner, you have access to a set of transactions that other miners don't. And so it tends to mining becoming more centralized because bigger operators are more likely to receive transactions out of band and they can invest more into the technology around transaction selection to maximize their fees. And so it increases the economies of scale of Bitcoin mining.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the reason some people get passionate about this, because the whole point about Bitcoin and what makes it special is that it is decentralized. So everybody's trying to do everything they can to make it as decentralized as possible. So something like this could be argued that it kind of impacts that decentralization in a slightly negative way. I mean, it doesn't break Bitcoin, but it could possibly make Bitcoin a bit less decentralized, where people want it to be as decentralized as possible. So that's really why there's the controversy. But okay, I've got some avenues, Australian. Kind of, I guess, crypto-related, but this is from Australian Financial Review. ASIC gets its first win against the crypto industry. The crypto regulator has notched up its first win against the crypto industry after a court found that startup Block Earner had offered an unlicensed financial product to retail investors. So basically, I haven't heard of Block Earner, but it was some kind of crypto
A Sydney company, actually.
They had some kind of products where you can earn a yield or whatever, or interest on just kind of crypto products. And ISIC decided that that was actually an online financial product that they were offering.
Yeah, yeah. So Block Earner, yeah, their company in Sydney, their primary product now is collateralized lending. And I think this is interesting and important for us to discuss maybe because there are no Bitcoin-only collateralized lending options in Australia. And so people that want to take advantage, and there are legitimate reasons why you might want to take advantage of collateralized lending, which is primarily about either leveraging your Bitcoin, which is maybe not the best idea, but you know, that's a risk people can take if they want to. And also the other reason you might want to do it is for tax purposes. So by taking a loan out against your Bitcoin, you can access some of that Bitcoin without realizing a capital gain, which can be useful for some people for sure. The things that you want to be really careful of if you're ever thinking of taking a collateralized loan is, firstly, what is that company doing? How are they custodying my funds? Because to lend against it, they're going to have to take control in some way. Now, we've seen in the Bitcoin space, the best practice for that is collaborative custody. So using multi-signature where one party holds a key, you hold a key, and then some arbitration setup is involved that holds the deciding key, I guess. And so in that case, you can actually be sure that your collateral isn't being rehypothecated, which would be against the interests of Bitcoin and against your interests. The other thing that I think is really important to consider if you were going to look at a company like this, which I wouldn't recommend, is whether that loan can be rolled over. So if you take on a loan to avoid some kind of tax implication or minimize your tax, if you're not able to roll over that loan at the end of the loan period, which is typically short because these products are novel still, so you might be looking at 1 year, 2 years. I don't know if there's any options that are offered yet for 4 years, which would probably be more acceptable in terms of Bitcoin's sort of historical cycles. But you've got no guarantee that you're going to be able to roll over these loans. And so we saw this actually very recently with Unchained Capital, where people have been taking out collateralized loans, and Unchained Capital seems to have had the rug pulled out on them a little bit by whoever their lending partner is, whoever provides them their capital for lending. And so they are not opening any more collateralized loan positions, no new positions. So I'm unsure of whether people are able to roll over those loans that they currently have existing. But it's just something to keep in mind that there's no guarantee if you take out a loan at the moment whether you'll be able to roll that over at the end of the period. So you may actually end up coming undone in terms of your plans in that way. The other thing that I would also think is a definite consideration is that despite the fact that you might have the perfect custody setup where the control of the Bitcoin is managed appropriately, even if there's a collaborative custody setup, then the creditors to the company may still have a legal claim in the case that the company goes insolvent. So if you're going to get involved with some kind of collateralized lending company, you want to be damn well sure that they're not going to do stupid shit like operating other credit products or whatever Block Earner was doing with, you know, like just yield farming, all that nonsense. You want to be damn sure they're not shitcoiners, basically, because that mindset is going to bring the company undone at some point. However long that takes, we're not sure, but it will come undone at some point. And there may be a legal claim to your Bitcoin. So you want to be certain of the status of your legal contract with the firm, or you just don't want to get in bed with shitcoiners.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I really don't recommend people use these kind of companies. There's a very long history of people losing their money with these types of companies. I guess there's two ways you can use them. It seems you can either put your like coins on them and get some kind of yield and get a loan. Either way, if you get a loan, sometimes people use that to buy Bitcoin, essentially you're leveraging yourself, but Bitcoin is still pretty volatile and can go down. And I've heard many stories where people kind of leverage themselves essentially to get a loan and buy more Bitcoin. And then Bitcoin goes down, so they have to actually get liquidated. And then after, they have to put the money back in. And after that, Bitcoin price goes back up. By that time, they actually got liquidated already. And so it doesn't work out for them. And getting all these yield products, again, like there's a big history of getting people trying to get return on Bitcoin and end up losing on it because they're like Celsius. But before Celsius, there was so many other ones, and people like just keep it simple, hold Bitcoin in secure cold storage, and you'll be doing good.
Yeah, I think there is a case for collateralized lending to emerge. I can see there are good arguments for why it would happen. I just think it's going to take time for a proper credit market to develop in that sense. And then also in the long term, it's questionable whether credit will be, well, it definitely won't be anywhere near as pervasive as it is now, but sort of it's questionable what sort of role credit will have in the long, long term with Bitcoin anyway. So I think in the short term, it's not a good idea. In the medium term, if a credit market sort of develops while hyper-Bitcoinization is still underway and you can get some kind of like, you can get a collateralized lending with a Bitcoin-only firm that is in line with the ethos and isn't going to fuck it all up, maybe it's worth it. And then in the long term, again, it's probably not worth it again. What a month. We're back.
It's pretty crazy. This month, February, had the biggest monthly increase ever in Bitcoin's history. It went up around $19,000 in just 1 month.
It's pretty extraordinary. Though, keeping in mind, as a percentage, we've seen bigger months, but yeah, just an outright dollar figure, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's correct. Even in percentage, something like 42% up in 30 days. So that's still like a pretty decent.
it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah, can't complain. I think we first met each other at the Bush Bash. I think it might have been the first Bush Bash.
My first Bush Bash was the 2021 Myrandai. So
I'm not sure if it was that one, but I remember one of them. Maybe it was the first Bush Bash. Basically, I remember it was going up. It just kind of pretty much reached the previous peak. So it reached like around $19,000. And everybody at the Bush Bash was so happy. It reached $19,000. It was around that, and now we just went up $19,000 in 1 month. So crazy.
Well, that's what Bitcoin does. That's what we're here for.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, we're just speculating, and we were talking about some patterns, but any price predictions, we could be wrong. At the start of February, it was $65,000, went up to, it's around $100,000. So it beat its all-time high in Australian dollars. We beat that. And I think right now we're pretty much at or just below the previous all-time high in US dollars. Just in February, we went over $1 trillion in market cap. That was like about 2 weeks ago. And now we're around $2 trillion in market cap. So as a comparison, I'm going to type the market cap of some different assets. And this is all in US dollars. Superannuation in Australia, it's around 2.3 trillion. So we're just below the value of super in Australia. We're still below the biggest companies in the world, Apple and Microsoft. They're both around 3 trillion. Gold, Alex, pop quiz question for you. Do you know the market cap of gold?
Yeah, it's over 10 trillion, isn't it?
That's correct. It's around 13 trillion. Some of these things are estimates because we don't really know, like some people hold gold in secret and things like that, I'm guessing. So, but the number I have is 13 trillion. So we're about 6 times lower. We still have a bit of way to go before we beat gold. The US broad money, do you know, another pop quiz, do you know the value of that?
Oh, no, I don't. But I'm going to say something like 200 trillion.
Well, 20 trillion. 20 trillion. Yeah. So global equities, it's around 100. So all the equities in the world are valued at around 110 trillion. So Bitcoin is 2% of global equities. And all global assets. So again, this is an estimate, but I done some research on this. And so the value of all global assets in the world, so that's equities, real estate, basically everything, that's valued at 500 trillion. So anyway, just to kind of give a comparison of where we are. In terms of like why the price has risen, obviously there's the ETFs, there's always money coming in through the ETFs, people are buying it up. the halving is about to come and we're coming out of a bear cycle. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely feeling very bullish right now.
Yeah. Well, I think the most interesting thing, and I think we said this last time, and I think it's still holding true for us, and I've also seen Alex Leishman from River in the US and a few other people saying on Twitter and other places that, yes, the price is running, but on the exchanges, we're not seeing that huge surge in retail action yet. So I guess that leads you to believe that it's all being driven at a sort of like an institutional level and with the ETFs. I just think that's really interesting because I guess you'd have to read into that a little bit. But my read of that is that, you know, that retail interest is still yet to come.
I think you're probably right. I think, you know, it's, yeah, I think it's just getting started. Basically, we're at the previous all-time high.
Yeah, well, one thing that's getting shared a lot is the Google Trends search data for Bitcoin. And it's still flatlining, basically. Like there was a little tiny spike around the launch of the ETFs compared to the past, like with the 2017 and the 2021 bull runs. It's almost like no one's paying attention yet, which is, I just think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess it's going to start getting attention now and people are going to start buying in. But or is it going to go up? Again, like, I don't know. I can't predict the price for sure. Patterns don't always repeat. But historically, when it comes out of a bear market and beats the previous all-time high, the next 6 months after it beats the previous all-time high, it's always like, goes up for the next 6 months, doubling or tripling the price at least.
As Czech will tell you, though, there's always pullbacks on the way up.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah. There'll be some pullbacks, but yeah, of course. I'll just to even kind of show my point, I'll share the screen, look at the chart. And for people listening on the podcast, I'll kind of walk people through. So this is the price chart. Okay, around March 2013, it beat its previous all-time high, but it was $32. And then, you know, the next 6 months or whatever, it's been going up. It went up to $1,000. Then around April 2017, it beat its previous all-time high of $1,000, $1,500. And then just again, next 6 months kept on pretty much almost straight up, with one or two small pullbacks, but kept on rising. Okay, so in November 2020, 19,000, yeah. And then for the next 4 months, it went up. But that was kind of like a bit different. It did have like a dip, a small dip, but only to 37,000. But basically, next 6 months were pretty bullish. So again, the pattern has been that each time it beat its previous all-time high, like the 6 months, it just doubles or triples at least. It's possible, but that will happen again. I think that's kind of enough of the price talk. I hope that sheds some light. And
what about Bitcoin Week?
Oh, Bitcoin Week. Okay. Oh, yeah. I should probably mention that. Yeah. So we had the, yeah, Australian Bitcoin Week. We already mentioned it on the, had the episode with Chris last week about Bitcoin Live. But yeah, it's coming up. The Australian Bitcoin Week is starting with the Bitcoin Bush Bash in Beechworth in Victoria. That's a free event, and that's on 16th and 17th of March.
If you come up to Beechworth on Friday evening, there'll be a BitDevs, I think, starting around 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock at the RSL. And then the 16th and the 17th, I'll be educating you on what spam is, the basic definition of spam.
Yeah, that's right. And the week after, it's Bitcoin Alive, which is the biggest Bitcoin event in Australia, in Sydney. And yeah, I'll be going to both of these events. And yeah, if anybody wants to learn, these are great opportunities to meet Bitcoiners and ask them questions and learn about Bitcoin. Code Hideblock and get 10% off. Yeah, so I think that's it. So see everyone next time.